Okay, so thank you, Hélène, and thank you, Ariel, for inviting here. And I will talk about microRNA, but let me, before giving you an introduction and some more data on peroneural nets. So the general interest of our laboratory is on plasticity, and in particular on developmental plasticity. So this form of plasticity that is particularly present during development, and that is probably linked to the formation of appropriate circuits that will drive behavior when you become adult. The classical model to study developmental plasticity was introduced by Hubel and Wiesel, and is this monocular deprivation that is performed simply by suturing or covering one eye, and then you can assess plasticity by, for instance, recording from the visual cortex neuronal activity, and you can have this so-called ocular dominance shift, meaning that the cortex becomes lose responsiveness to the deprived eye, and if you wait for days and days, you also see some increase in the response to the non-deprived eye. So what is interesting is that if you do the same manipulation in adult animal, you have much less of an effect, indicating that plasticity is regulated during development. So questions that we try to ask in the lab is what mechanism reduces plasticity? Of course, is interesting for visual cortex, but also to exploit this knowledge to have some tricks to enhance plasticity, which in some condition could be useful, of course. So that's why we became interested in these perineuronal nets that you see here as a staining in the adult visual cortex. We also use this WFA, and you can see that there is quite a clear overlap with parvalbumin neurons. Although I have to stress, even considering the previous talk also yesterday, that you see, for instance, that there are some cells that do not have a net, although they are parva expressing. So we don't really know so much of the regulation of these perineuronal nets and why these are naked and while the other are, dressed with a net. What was interesting in this perineuronal net in relationship with the critical period is that they appear very late in the cortex during development. So basically, their appearance is occurs when plasticity declines. Moreover, there is another interesting point that also Ariel alluded to yesterday, that this is a dynamic structure which is regulated by activity and by experience. So if you do, for instance, dark reading, so keep animal in total darkness, you have a really poor development of perineuronal nets. And even if in other experiment, if you interfere with activity in an adult animal, you can have a change, for instance, with environmental enrichment, or if you apply GABA antagonist, you can have a change, a modulation of the number of WFA positive perineuronal nets. So I think that it's important to think that also that this is a dynamic structure. And of course, looking with WFA, you only look at the tip of the iceberg. You can, of course, think about molecular changes in the composition of the net. So when we apply chondroitinase ABC, which digests these lateral sugar chains of the chondroitin sulfate proteoglycans in the adult visual cortex, we could have the plasticity that we get in juvenile animals. And we could also exploit this plasticity for a good purpose, because when you deprive a young animal, you get this loss of visual acuity, this amblyopia. But if you take an adult amblyopic animal and you give chondroitinase, it is able to recover normal visual acuity. With chondroitinase, you digest these lateral chains of chondroitin sulfate proteoglycans in the net, but also everywhere, because these CSPGs are present in a diffuse form, also in the whole extracellular matrix, probably. So to really test whether it was the organization of the net rather than the mere presence of the CSPG that was important, we analyzed together with James a mouse model which basically misses this link protein, CRTL1 protein, in the brain. And this protein is necessary to organize the perineuronal net. And if you don't have this protein, you have a very disorganized perineuronal net. But importantly, the CSPG overall level are not changed. So we can really test whether it's the structure or it's the amount that is important. And when we analyze plasticity in the adult visual cortex of these animals, we could see that if you do monocular deprivation in the knockout, you get a reduction of this index that basically is a plasticity index. So meaning that you have plasticity in the adult animal, while you don't have plasticity if you deprive a wild type animal. So this is an indication that it's really the net rather than the diffuse CSPG levels that is important for this form of plasticity. Now we have also repeated some of these analyses, trying to really see if some features that are typical of the juvenile form of plasticity are present in the adult link knockout. Namely, you can have some, for instance, increase in the non-deprived eye responses in adult mice, even in wild type, with prolonged monocular deprivation. But the features of a juvenile plasticity are like which are the reduction in the response to the deprived eye and the loss of visual acuity. These are also present in the link mouse. So the link mouse really show the features of plasticity that are typical of juvenile animals, even if, of course, they are adult animals. And this was done using this technique of optical imaging that allowed to do repeated measurement before and after monocular deprivation, but still testing the same index that I showed you before. Of course, the $1 million question is how do these perineuronal nets inhibit plasticity? And again, we have heard yesterday of a possible mechanism for which CSPG could basically facilitate the entrance of OTX2 into the neurons. But of course, interaction between CSPG and proteins is an interesting mechanism, and also the peptide that should mediate that is not only present in OTX2. So also other molecules could be concentrated at the perineuronal net. So the perineuronal net could be kind of a hub to concentrate around particular type of neurons, certain type of molecules. And again, together with James and Jos Verhagen, we studied semaphore in 3A, because there was this very striking overlap, you see, in the staining between WFA and SEMA3A. You see that there is really complete overlap between this staining. And the SEMA3A expression in the visual cortex has really the same properties of the perineuronal nets. So this is the developmental increase from young to adult. And you see here the WFA, and you see here the SEMA3A. So it has the same developmental regulation of WFA, and also has the same regulation by dark rearing. So again, if you dark rear animals, you don't have development of the perineuronal nets, and you also see very, very few SEMA3A stain cells. So this was suggesting that SEMA3A could be one of the factors that are concentrated at the net. And considering its inhibitory action, for instance, on sprouting, we imagine that could participate to the inhibition of plasticity in the adult visual cortex. So Jost made some receptor bodies to basically antagonize SEMA3A using the portion of the SEMA3A receptor neuropilin 1. Unfortunately, neuropilin 1 also binds to VEGF, so he had to work a little bit more, and he made a receptor body that has basically binds to both receptor body that is specific for SEMA3A and another receptor body that is specific for VEGF. And he tested that they are able to block SEMA3 activity in an in vitro bioassay and prepare the adeno-associated virus that were injected P100 in the rat visual cortex. And we waited for the expression of the receptor bodies, and we could see that you have transduced cells, but you also have a lot of diffuse staining, indicated that the receptor body is actually released by the cell. And you see that when you have high expression of the receptor body, we started a monocular deprivation experiment. And eventually, we assess whether plasticity was present or not. This graph summarizes all the different experimental groups. And again, this is the same contra-ipsy ratio, the same index of plasticity, if you want. And if you have low values, it means that ocular dominance was present, so indicates plasticity. This is basically control, non-deprived, no transfection rats. These are the rats injected just with the empty vector expressing GFP, or the one that binds to VEGF. And for all these conditions, you don't have any plasticity. But we got plasticity with these two with two receptor bodies. One is the general one, and the one is the one specific to SEMA3A, suggesting that actually antagonizing SEMA3A, you can activate plasticity similarly to what you get with the chondroitinase ABC treatment or with the knockout of the link protein. So, okay, how can we extrapolate these findings that we obtain in the visual cortex to our plasticity mechanism? We analyze fear memory because there was this paper by Pico Caroni's group, but again, this was made with a chondroitinase ABC, so we didn't really know whether the structure of the peripheral neural net was important or not. So we analyzed wild type and knockout animals, and we did this Q-fear conditioning, so an association between a sound and a shock. And you see here the learning curve that is the same for both group of animals. And after 10 days, we analyzed whether memory was still present or not. So we just administered the sound, basically, without any punishment, and we could see that there was freezing. Although there was at the moment trend for a little bit more freezing in the knockout animals. We also analyzed using this activity marker ZIF-268 the activation in the different parts of the amygdala in response to the sound, and it's interesting that in agreement with the trend for an increased freezing in the knockout, we could see a stronger activation in the knockout versus the wild type. So this seems to suggest that the learning has caused a stronger trace or at the level of the amygdala. But as you may have noticed from this graph, when you repeatedly apply the CS, so just the sound, it seems that the knockout response drops. This is a protocol that is called extinction, that is basically trying to exploit a kind of a flexibility in the behavior of these animals, trying to learn a new association, that now the conditioning, that the CS is not, you know, predictive of any damage anymore. And as you see, the knockout, which starts from high here, drops down very, very quickly. And this is the same observation that was done by Pico Caroni with chondroitinase ABC. So extinction, process is really much faster in the knockout animals. Normally, in wild type animals, you can also have some extinction of the fear memory, but this memory trace is particularly resistant, so you can have a spontaneous recovery of fear. So, for instance, if you end extinction and then you test the animals again after 7 days, you can have you see the reappearance of the fear memory, and or it can be spontaneous, or you can just give a shock, and just the shock reactivates the memory, and then the animal show freezing in response to the CS. And while this occurs in the wild type, it seems that the fear memory is really deleted in the knockouts. So the extinction protocol was able really to update the memory and update the value of the CS. And it's interesting. This is 7 days. We went, farther on in with time. 42 days. Again, the same effect. So it's as far as we. As we know, it's really a complete deletion of the trace. And indeed, this is also associated with a dramatic difference in the activation of the amygdala when we tested with ZIF-268 after extinction. We know that after extinction, the CS in the lateral amygdala can still activate the neurons. And this is an agreement with the fact that probably they show less fear because there are also there is also inhibition from the cortex, like from the prefrontal cortex. But you still can have activation from the CS. While in the knockout, there is completely loss of activation by the CS. So the levels of ZIF-268 are the same of the pseudo-conditioned animals that are the one that got the shock but didn't get the association between the cue and the shock. So this again tells that at the level of the memory trace is probably a completely different way of dealing with the trace. So while extinction in the knockout is able really to cancel the memory trace, and the extinction in the wild type is probably able to build another form of memory that basically is antagonistic with the fear condition memory. Okay, so we can. This plasticity is important for memory. Can be also exploited to promote recovery from a lesion condition. And to answer this question, we analyze a model of a focal cortical stroke delivered to the forelimb representation in the primary motor cortex. And basically, the idea was to induce this lesion and then to apply. In this case, we use chondroitinase to remove the perineuronal nets from the penumbra area, and to see whether could promote some improvement in motor skill learning. So here you see the damage and the area treated with chondroitinase, and you see the complete disappearance of the perineuronal net. But please note that also this kind of background staining has completely disappeared. And as I was saying before, there is a lot of CSPGs in a diffuse form. So this tells that this is not background. This is real chondroitinase-sensitive staining. So what happens in this skill-reaching task to the animals that has been stroked and treated with chondroitinase? So before lesion, you can have this nice learning curve, and after lesion, these are the control animal. You see very, some tendency for relearning, but very poor. While the chondroitinase treated animals, and these were treated on the cortex, you see that they are able to relearn the curve. So you don't have preservation of the former memory when you treat with chondroitinase. This was done after the lesion. But you put the circuit in a condition that is able to relearn the task. And this was done with acute treatment. But what was interesting for us is also to apply a delayed treatment, which is 2 weeks after the lesion. And you could see that even maybe a little bit less, but still you can get a learning curve after the lesion with chondroitinase, while the control animals learn quite poorly. So we can use this plasticity that we can activate with this chondroitinase treatment, even in a condition of lesion. Okay, so we use this model of ocular dominance plasticity, as I said at the beginning, to look for molecule controlling plasticity. And for us, of this story of the perineural net was of course very important, but we try to know more, to have more candidates. And in particular, we base our search on this question: what the hell is the visual experience doing to the visual cortex? Because after all, you change a circuit just closing one eye. So even passive stimulation for a few days, you can have an ocular dominance shift even with one day of monocular deprivation. So this visual experience continuously does something to neuronal cells that respond not only in terms of action potentials, but also in terms of gene expression and activation of a transduction signal that is so important during this temporal window of development. So the idea is to try to focus on the experience-dependent regulation of, for instance, of transcription to get good candidates for plasticity controllers. And this is important not only for to gain knowledge about normal functioning of the brain, but because these activity-dependent pathways are also those that are involved when you have mutation, are involved in monogenetic syndrome, including autism spectrum disorder symptoms. And this is from a Greenberg review. And it's interesting that, for instance, in autism, when a very large analysis of the genes that are mutated basically got, of course, many, many different factors. But if you group them in categories, there were three big categories. One is synaptic proteins, and this is kind of expected, because, of course, if you disrupt synapses, something can go wrong. The two other categories are chromatin control and transcriptional control, which is a little bit less expected maybe, because it indicates that really the relationship between activity and transcription is crucial for normal brain functioning. So we started this analysis with a very easy perturbation, which is just to put an animal into darkness and back to light. Very simple experiment, basically just switching on and off the light in a room. And what you get, you get an activation of this pathway, so phosphorylation of ERK, translocation to the nucleus, and interestingly, you see, of course, activation of gene expression, and in particular mediated by this transcription factor CREB, not only by CREB, of course, but CREB is activated, and CREB was well known because of its role in learning and memory. But also you get these post-translational modifications of histones that are the so-called epigenetic modification that can regulate the state of activity, let's say, of a given part of the DNA. So really switching on the light in a juvenile animals can make this big change in the way that genes are transcribed in the visual cortex. Of course, it was interesting to know what are these CREB control genes that are activated by experience in a very dynamic way. But another question was, what happens if you do the same experiment in an adult animal when plasticity is reduced? And we found that this part of the pathway was basically activated to the same extent, but those controlling here gene expression were down-regulated. So the effect of experience at the level of gene transcription is not disappear, of course, but is much less than what happens in juvenile animals. So, as I said, the first point was, what are these regulated genes? And we focus on we browse to the CREB-regulated genes, and we found this gene that was very interesting for us. It's a code basically for a bisystronic transcript, which produces two microRNAs. One is miR-212, which, however, in its mature form, is probably not so stable, so it's present at a very low concentration. And this other microRNA, miR-132. And why was that interesting? Because it was a very strongly CREB control in culture. Depolarization produces huge changes and very fast with time in a time of minutes, or in the induction of this microRNA. Of course, microRNAs are important because they control many other targets. So it could be, a hub controlling getting together different actuators of the plasticity program. And so we tested with this light on, light off, the expression of the miR-132, and we found that is very dynamically regulated. If you switch on the light, you can have a sevenfold increase in expression in 1 hour. So it's really even more than CFOS, I would say. It goes up and down. And after monocular deprivation, the expression of this microRNA becomes downregulated because of the lack of visual stimulation. So we decided to see whether there was a functional consequence of this downregulation of miR-132. How? We induce monocular deprivation in young mice, but then basically we counteracted the reduction of miR-132 applying a miR-132 mimic. So basically we kept the level of this microRNA stable in spite of the fact that there was monocular deprivation. And the hypothesis was that if the system needs this downregulation to activate the plasticity program, you should not have plasticity. And this is the result, of course, otherwise I would have not presented the data. But again, these are this index of plasticity. This is the non-deprived. The reduction in this ratio when you do monocular deprivation in a juvenile animal, this is what you get with a control, and you see no plasticity if you block the reduction of miR-132. So miR-132 was an important factor for plasticity. While we were doing these experiments, also Mirgan Kasur laboratory at MIT in Boston was doing working on this microRNA, but we are doing a different approach using a mRNA sponge transduced by using viruses in the cortex. And they also found that if you completely block miR-132, you also block plasticity. So we come up with this idea again of that you have to have an optimal level of this microRNA to get plasticity, and probably this is also why it's regulated physiologically, its level, probably to regulate the state of plasticity of the system. But this led us to ask another question, that is the last series of experiments that I'm going to show to you. Okay, we have a molecule that is crucial to have ocular dominance plasticity. But of course, these molecules were not made just in case we get monocular deprivation. They were made for development, to develop properly the circuit. So what happens, what is the visual development when a plasticity factor is missing? So without any deprivation, if we interfere with miR-132, what do we get? And the second question was, is miR-132 only, is there only one microRNA that regulates this mechanism, or this process of visual development involves this layer of regulation of microRNAs? So let's start from the second question. What we did is to do a small RNA-seq experiment and compare P10 and P28, which is two, let's say, age right at the beginning of the visual development, and when visual development is almost finished and when plasticity is at its peak. And we observed that many microRNAs are regulated, see 129, and in particular, in the top regulated microRNAs, again, miR-132 came out. So it's also regulated during development. This is strongly upregulated with development. And you see also these other guys. These two are particularly interesting for us because these are the ones described by Ben Barres for myelinization. And actually, myelinization is the main event occurring during this period. So it would be interesting to, we are starting a project also on that. But we focus on miR-132. We got the miR-132 knockout, and what we did is that in the same from the same samples from which we do this small RNA-seq, we also did a normal RNA-seq, so we could correlate the RNA, so probably the target of the microRNA, with the changes in the Mirna level. And in particular here we analyze the messenger RNA that become regulated with age, and you see that there are many, with those that remain upregulated in the absence of the miR-132. And you see there is a quite a big overlap. This is a very highly significant overlap. So this suggests that the downregulation that you get with age, that is not occurring when you miss the microRNA, is somehow mediated by the microRNA in the normal animal. So suggesting that miR-132 participate to sculpt the developmental transcriptome of the visual cortex. And we made also another comparison with the in silico prediction of the miR-132 targets. And again, you see that there are these 39 genes for which there is a prediction of direct interaction. Of course, this was not testing direct interaction, but this there are 39 of these miR-132 targets that remain upregulated in the knockout, but normally should go down in the normal mouse. And you see that among these 39, you see very interesting genes for neural development. P10 has been mutation in P10 has been described in autism, MSCP2 for Rett syndrome, and these are all genes with mutation causing neurodevelopmental disorders. So, okay, what about the other question? What happens to visual development when you miss a plasticity factor? We decided to do qPCR to better analyze the temporal profile of miR-132 expression in the cortex, and you see that that the increase that you get is really confined to this 10 days between P20 and P30. So after P20, there is this dramatic rise in miR-132 expression. And it's interesting that this is not genetically programmed, because if you analyze dark rear animals, you see that it stays flat. So what happens in coincidence with this rise in terms of visual cortical neuron functioning? That, of course, this would be a logical candidate for a functional role of miR-132. So I have overlapped this developmental curve with this other graph that comes from a Mike Stryker review. And this shows that, for instance, development of orientation selectivity, which is a property of visual cortical neurons for which they basically respond only to stimuli that are of a certain orientation, for instance, vertical but not to horizontal, you see that, of course, probably before this period. Of course, there is a tail here, but the big part, of course, earlier than that. But what occurs here, which is, of course, also the period of plasticity, is this so-called binocular matching of orientation preference. Basically, as I said, cortical neurons are selective for a given orientation. And normally, if you take an adult animal and you test the right eye or the left eye, the preference is the same. So a cortical neurons would prefer the vertical, both if you test to the left or to the right eye. But if you take a very young animal, what happens is that this preference is not matched. You have orientation selectivity, but if you test through the right eye, you can have a neuron preferring the vertical, and through the left eye, it could be, you know, kind of an oblique or almost horizontal. Then there is a matching that is experience dependent, because if you do dark reading, the orientation preference does not match, remain unmatched. So we analyze all these properties during development of wild type and knockout mice for this microRNA. And we did this by extracellular recordings with multi-electrode and then spike sorting to have very selective units. And here you see orientation selectivity, direction selectivity, all these properties that develop early are perfectly normal. These are the knockout and the wild type. So there is no effect on this visual properties. But when we analyze orientation preference between the two eyes, you see that the angle preferred by the left or right eye in a wild type is aligned. This is a P30 animal, P27, sorry, animal. While in the knockout, you have this difference in the preferred orientation. So there is this process of binocular matching is altered in this knockout. Of course, we also tested whether our model was really missing ocular dominance plasticity, because as I said, Mirgan Kasura had done it in a different way with a sponge with viral transduction, and it does. So if you do monocular deprivation, you don't in a wild type you get the effect, in the knockout you don't get the effect. But this also allow us to test another thing. So we know that monocular deprivation perturbs binocular matching. We know that knocking out MIR-132 perturbs binocular matching. But are these effects additive or they occlude each other? Because of course, if we, as we think, a visual experience X by MIR-132, the two manipulations should occlude each other, could not sum up. And indeed, this is the result. So this is the alignment that you get in a P27 wild type, and this is the impairment that you get in a wild type when you have monocular deprivation, and you see that it's the same that you get in the knockout. And even if you combine, so you deprive the knockout, you cannot go any farther than that. What could be the behavioral consequences of having an animal with cells in the cortex that has an unmatched orientation preference? Yes, these cells would be binocular, of course, but they could not examine at the same time the visual stimuli, because, for instance, if a cell likes the vertical through one eye but the horizontal to the other, and it's stimulated with the vertical, it will respond only basically to one pathway, right? So missing this binocularity is important for depth perception. Actually, for instance, we didn't find any problem with visual acuity in these animals. So we tested depth perception behaviorally using this test, which is called the visual cliff. Basically, you put the animal on a glass, and underneath you can have visual stimuli at different depth. So you have a shallow side and a deep side, and the animals will always stay on the shallow side. They avoid going on the deep side. This test, to do this, to show this preference, you need both eyes open. If we take one, if you see here in binocular condition, you have a preference for the shallow side, but if you just close one eye, and then you retest the animal, it will go everywhere because it's not able to appreciate the depth in the stimuli. If you eliminate the depth cue because you put the two visual stimuli at the same height, you don't have any preference at this time. So there is no some intrinsic preference in the apparatus for which they stay more on one side than in the other. And even if you measure, for instance, time spent in the center of the arena, which is could be an index of an anxiety-like behavior, you don't have any difference between wild type and KO. So we really think that we are testing, what we are testing is something that requires the two eyes open, requires binocularity. So we put in the visual cliff the wild type, the knockout, and the monocularly deprived wild type. And basically, you see that the preference for the shallow side is strongly reduced, indicating that there is an impairment in depth perception in these animals. We also analyzed animals at P60, because of course this could be maybe just a small transient delay in development, but then the two curves could get together later on during life. But at P60, the difference is absolutely the same. You see that there is actually an improvement in the wild type in the binocular matching, but the unmatching in the knockout remains at the same level. And the same for the behavioral test. And finally, we ask, okay, what could be the cell type that is in the visual cortex involved in this effect of MIR-132? previous work by Josh Wang has shown that this microRNA is more expressed in excitatory cells. So I'm sorry, this is not really the PARVA-related data for this meeting, but it's more expressed in excitatory cells. We also saw a small but significant reduction in spine density in pyramidal cells, of course, excitatory. But then we decided to analyze the phenotype of the conditional knockout for MIR-132 crossed with the MX1 CRADA combinase mouse. And basically, to make a long story short here, the parental lines, either the Phlox mouse or the one expressed in the recombinase, they have normal binocular matching, and also in the behavior they perform normally, but there is a disalignment when we have the conditional remover of MIR-132 from excitatory neurons. This is what you get using this line. So we think that MIR-132 acts to in excitatory neurons, is requiring excitatory neurons for this process of alignment of inputs. So I finish here, and let me thank the people in the lab. Without them, of course, this would be absolutely impossible. Particular Paola Tognini, she did all the work with MIR-132 and also other stuff on epigenetics that I've not shown. Raffaele, Leonardo, they did the optical imaging part and all this last part on binocular matching. Elena Putignano, she did a fantastic job again with the epigenetic part. And of course, our collaboration, long-term collaboration with James and Jos Verhagen and the other in the group. So thank you very much for your attention.